All right, welcome back to another episode of We All Speak in Poems. So today's a little bit of a special episode. I've been wanting to have Taylor Dupree on since I started this podcast. He's one of my favorite artists, probably has been the most inspiring, especially ambient artist, ever since I started making my own music. And Andrew Tasselmeyer, who has also been on the podcast before, recently started his podcast, Sound Methods. When I first saw Sound Methods, I was taken aback by how meaningful it seemed, the intros he made for the artist, the descriptions he made. And with that being said, I just wanted him to be part of this episode. I knew that he would make it more special. The questions he'd help me come up with would be that much better. And to be honest, he came up with a vast majority of the questions that we're about to ask Taylor here. So with that being said, I hope you enjoyed the episode. So, Andrew, I'm actually going to start with one of your questions because I like it a lot. Taylor, when me and Andrew were sort of setting up for this conversation, we were talking a lot about what side of things would be interesting to speak about rather than, you know, the typical interviews that we've heard about you and read from you multiple times, you know, from different outlets. But you've built a reputation and a business as a mastering engineer for a huge range of artists at this point. It's sort of mind-blowing to think about how much time you must have spent listening in a very intentional and active way to other people's music. And this is on top of the music that you release, you know, as 12K, on 12K. Do you ever feel like fatigued or uninspired when it comes to producing your own music because of the mastering business and all the active listening that you do?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think I'm ever uninspired to write, except maybe, I mean, I guess that's maybe what writer's blocks are, you know, or just not. I always want to write, whether I can or not is a different story. I don't think it's a lack of inspiration. And I don't think it's from all the listening I do. It's more of just being in the studio all day, working on something else, and then, you know, hours later, you know, needing a break and needing to get out of here, and then, you know, finding the time more mostly to get back in and do something. But it is a shift of, you know, it's a shift of focus, you know, like you said, from listening to creating. But I don't think it's because I'm doing all this listening, you know, it's just more of a time thing. I'd say, you know, if anything, so much of the music I hear is really inspirational.
Yeah, you know, true.
Because there's a lot of, you know, I just finished a master today that's just like this incredible, like, trumpet, drum, ambient sax thing, you know, that's super cool and really inspirational.
Yeah, for sure.
And then you hear total crap that just, you know, kills it. But, you know, it's really, I think, more of a time thing.
For sure. I think I like this question that Andrew came up with so much because I find when I listen to a lot of music at once, even when I do find it inspiring, it like almost promotes a writer's block. Like I then have to go on a purge of like 1 or 2 days of not listening to any music at all to actually get anything done. I think maybe that's just because I end up comparing myself to the work that I'm inspired by. Do you feel that ever, like, in terms comparing yourself?
Yeah, traditionally, ever since the 90s, even more in the 90s, maybe, or it started then, is I was coming up as a professional musician in the techno world and just comparing myself to everything else. But I think that's probably true for a lot of new musicians because, you know, in my experience, new musicians tend to emulate the people they really like. And it takes a long time to find your own voice and stuff like that. So it was really when I got out of the techno world and wanted to go, you know, pursue my interest in ambient music, did I really find my own voice and less trying to be like someone else. You know, I wasn't, less trying to be like someone else and more finding my own voice. But I do compare myself constantly with others, you know, less so now in it, maybe in a way like I'm not as good and more like, wow, that's really cool. Like, I wish I did that sort of thing. Yeah. Or how can I do that, but put my own spin on it or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I think my general insecurity about myself and, you know, there is constant comparisons, and if not thinking I'm not good enough, hoping that I am, you know, is probably more precise.
I think that's probably one of the benefits of like the sort of community or genre that we're in, since ambient is such a blanket, you know, term. It could range from, people yeah. are calling solo piano stuff ambient now, like purely classical almost. You know, whereas with techno, it even makes sense, since, at least to my understanding, I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to other electronic genres. You know, it's so rigid and structured, and like, I can see there's probably templates, or at least more templates in that space than there are in ambient.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, yeah, sorry. Like,
no.
Techno, like you have a techno song and then you take a preset from some synth and make a bass line, and all of a sudden it's a new genre.
Yeah.
Right. And then all you have to do that genre is take that same preset and do the same bass line and put everything else around it. And your ambient, for some reason, has not splintered off into like 5 million subgenres. Maybe there's drone music. Maybe that's different.
Yeah.
That's like all I, but there's a lot of different ambient styles. And I'm kind of glad that it hasn't put itself into all those categories like that, because that would kind of stress us all out, I think. I don't know.
Exactly. Like, the funny thing is, I've heard your music, Taylor, like be described as lowercase music, whatever that even means. Andrew's is like a lot of drone stuff. And I've even heard my stuff be called like Ambient X lately, which is funny. But it seems like people don't actually even want to stick to these terms. It's just sort of maybe like a, I don't know, an editorial thing probably at like the big tech companies like Spotify or something that are just trying their hardest not to call everything, you know, dreamy right. ambient playlist number 60, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in some levels it would probably help to have different genre names. But yeah, I was talking about this with Marcus the other year, like trying to come up with a genre for like what we do. And the only thing that we came up with that we liked was discrete music, which is another way to rip off Eno. But I felt like that, you know, because it's similar to ambient, but it almost sounds like a genre name.
Yeah.
And it would be for like whatever this stuff that we do is. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we weren't serious about trying to genreify ourselves. We were just like, if, you know, what are some of the possibilities?
Yeah. I started my discussion with him on the topic of how do you label your music, or how would you describe it to people? And I was kind of joking with him about his minimal grunge label. I love that he calls his music minimal grunge. And like, there's this whole conversation to be had about the after the fact labeling of music. And I'm always interested to hear what people think of when they're going into it to start with, like absent the people labeling it or calling it a certain thing after the fact, how are you personally approaching it? How are you thinking about it? What would you use to describe the kinds of processes and techniques and ideas that go into your music? And for that reason, I really, really love the 12 principles that you've got on the 12K site. I've looked at those so many times. I mean, even as someone not personally connected to the label in any way, I still find myself revisiting those actually on a regular basis, just to kind of take as inspiration for the work that I do. And I'd be really curious to hear your perspective, Taylor, That's cool. on how those principles came to be. How did you formulate them? Did they take shape over time? Were those things that kind of you knew you wanted to establish the label with? Or what was the process to get to those 12 points? How did they emerge?
It was a long time ago, but so I don't remember exactly, but they basically came out all at once. And it was sort of like, I think I pretty much did it around the time I started the label, like in 1997. And I think they're inspired by the 10 principles of design by Dieter. I like this idea of like these, you know, the idea of these principles, and Dieter Rams's principles for design are incredibly good. And as a, at the time I was a professional graphic designer, and his, well, his principles are probably more related to hardware design, since he was a designer of physical objects. They still resonate with graphic design a lot. You know, design should be functional. Design should help, you know, make something easier to use. You know, design shouldn't get in the way. That kind of thing. You know, I probably did those principles like a little bit after I started the label, because I'm talking like months or maybe a release or two, you know, as things got going. But when I did them, I thought they were cool, and they were just sort of helped me focus the label. But I never thought that 25 years later, they would all be still completely true, which is kind of funny. You know, I don't read them every day. I don't sit there and, you know, start my morning reading one and run my life that way. It's just like, it's what I did then and it's what I do now. And I haven't even really tried, you know, I guess they were so true in a way. Not that they're true or false, but they were so true to me that they're still, you know, they're still just as valid.
Yeah. It's kind of, it is amazing. I think you just said, you know, 25 years on, here we are. Like, would there ever be a time where you feel a need to add to those? Or is it just like, it is what it is. This is, you know.
Well, there's 12 right. of them, yeah. So I can't really add any.
Make the jump to 15K. You know,
I think I could probably add, you know, I've never thought about that, just because I knew that it's got to just be right. 12. But yeah, I'm sure I could come up with more, or even clean up the wording. Or, I mean, that wording is word for word 25 years old. You know, I'm probably a better writer now, and I can say something more concisely, but, you know, I don't feel like I should touch them.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. I haven't.
I think in like a time where everybody is starting labels and can start labels whenever they want, like, it must be the thing that sets 12K apart. Like, obviously you've been around for 25 years and it's like a legacy brand now, almost, in ambient, at least in my opinion. But the fact that, yeah, you're right. You have stuck by that, and you can tell by that, you know, it really sets you apart. Musicians or artists listening to this, like reading those and sort of trying to see a way of applying it to yourself, kind of like I did, I think is really important. Like, if you have these 12 principles, instead of trying to chase the carrot all the time, like trying to chase these principles is a much better guideline than the current, you know, digital,
right,
you know, thing of doing it, at least in terms of longevity, in my opinion.
Yeah, and they could probably be interpreted, you know, a little bit differently for everybody, or like you said, like take what you want out of them, or interpret in your own way. And, you know, it's not unlike, what's it called? You're gonna have to edit this part. It's not unlike the oblique strategies.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, it's not unlike Eno's oblique strategies, where they're not hard and fast rules, you know, they're just little guiding ideas or whatever, and you can interpret them your own way.
Exactly. Yeah, I think everybody's is essentially trying to find these things on which to know themselves, almost. And I think it's a great place to start, like any of these things, or even the 10 design ones, like transferring that over into life in general, not just art, is important, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they do translate into life or other art forms, or I think.
Yeah.
For sure.
I'm just calling them up over here.
I had a tab open with them too.
They're pretty concise, I must say.
Yep.
I don't think I could make them any more concise. They're like less yeah. than a sentence each.
Yeah. And I had to ask the question because the last one, number 12, is everything will change. And so, like I do try to keep that in mind for myself personally. I tend to fall into creative ruts or like get stuck, and I have to remind myself to, you know, be open to the possibility or the prospect of change every now and then. And I do want to ask you, Taylor, I can think of like a sound in my head when I think of the music that you make, but I don't really, it's interesting because I was thinking about it. I have favorite musicians and I can associate them with specific instruments or tools. Like I have favorite guitarists, I have favorite bass players, but maybe it's this ambient space where it's harder to do that. It's harder to associate people with, you know, the equipment that they use. Would you say that you have drawn more inspiration from a specific instrument or tool over the years more than others? Like, would you be able to call yourself a certain, you know, instrument player? Or do you not think about it like that? Are you thinking mostly about the, like the music as a whole? How would you describe yourself as a musician?
Like an instrument player, like keyboard, right. guitar, yeah. or like a specific synth
yeah,
or something?
Exactly. Yeah. Do you, like, would you call yourself a synthesist, for instance?
No, I mean, you know, I get asked that, or when I meet people like in town or like my, you know, you meet someone at a party or a parent of a kid's friend or something, mm-hmm. and you have to, you know, the dreaded question is, what do you do for a living?
Been there. Yep.
And, you know, fortunately now,
I mean,
little tangent here, but fortunately now I just say I'm an audio engineer because everything else just gives like a blank stare, you know, like I can't say mastering engineer because most people don't know what that is.
Yep.
And then I have to go in to explain it. Audio engineer, you know, people probably don't really know what that is, but, you know, they get it enough where they stop asking you. So, but, you know, if I do say I'm a musician or people know I'm a musician, they ask, what instrument do you yep. play? And my first response is usually a little bit of everything and nothing at all well. If I had to join like a rock band tomorrow, I'd probably join as a drummer. Mm. I think that's in terms of, you know, regular music, I could probably fake my way most through being a drummer. I think I have really good rhythm and I was a drummer when I was younger. Yep. But you know, the real answer for people who might get it more, and it's really going back to like the Eno thing where, you know, that my instrument is the studio.
Yep.
So, cause I love the studio. I love the gear and the equipment, and it's not about one piece of gear. It's about how multiple things hook together or work together. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, I mean, yeah, synth player, you know, I mean, but I don't really play them, you know, as much as I get tones out of them, you
right,
know.
Right.
I think people know that about me or that it comes across, you know, just that I love the technology and I love the studio as a tool and, you know, I'm not precious about anything at all, and everything can be affected and ripped apart and thrown away. But I, you know, I need technology to make my art. I always have.
Yep.
You know, I went to university for photography, and I love visual art, but I need technology. I need a camera to make my art. I can't take a piece of paper and a paintbrush.
Yep.
And do anything. You know, I can't. I mean, I sort of can, but I can't really pick up an acoustic guitar and play and sing a song.
Yep.
You know, I need the looper. I need the, you know, I need all these technological crutches to express myself for
yeah.
better or for worse.
Right there with you.
I love that. And I very much see myself in the same way. And I think a long time ago, I read somewhere that you see your studio as the instrument kind of thing. And that really stuck with me because in a way it's almost like modular or something. You can literally unconnect, reconnect things in a specific way and get certain workflows. You know, you can be completely in the box, you can be half in the box, fully outboard gear. And looking at things in that way, and sort of instead of trying to compose music in a way, try to set up sequences or workflows that'll just compose for you. I think I really got out of listening to your music for years, you know, and like I would assume that's the way that you kind of see it as well. But like, how much actual composition go into writing for you?
I mean, any kind of composition in a traditional sense, probably not much. I don't use any really automated generative processes. You know, maybe, I mean, there's got to be certain, like, I'm looking around. I mean, so much of my music is based on loopers, right? And those loopers, I'm inputting everything, you know, by hand, whether it's a sequence of chords or a couple notes, but it's the overdubbing in the layers that allow me to make something sound more complex or more harmonic or more musical. So, you know, I'm setting up these systems like based around loopers, but it's not really making the music for me. I mean, it isn't, you know, I mean, I'm inputting everything. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like,
yeah.
It's playing back what I put in, and once you get a bunch of different loops going, then it starts to be generative.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm looking over at, like, my modular synth, and I have a couple sequencers that truly are generative. They, you know, they'll spit out random notes based on a scale, and I want to like those, but I never end up liking them, because there'll always be, like, a wrong note in there for me, so I like to have the control, the note-by-note control that generative stuff often doesn't allow.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Was,
yeah. This whole conversation is kind of reminding me, at some point you had told me kind of how SOMI, that my favorite album of yours, mm-hmm. was sort of composed and made. And it was kind of in this way, right? Where you said, you know, you'd play, you know, a few notes on the piano over the course of 4 minutes, run back to the studio, stop it, you know, do another take, and like it was kind of constant overdubbing. Is this the kind of workflow that you're sort of talking about in this way?
Yeah, I mean, SOMI was like a really extended version of what I typically do. Like that was like play one note. I had a timer in front of me, right? And I'd set it for 19 seconds. Play a note, wait 19 seconds. Play, you know, watch the timer, play the same note. It was the most boring thing. And when I described the album to people as I was writing it, they just thought it was the most boring, you know, because it sounds, you know, wait 19 seconds, play the same note. Because I didn't want to use loopers, right? I wanted to be the looper. And I'm not going to hit that note on 19 seconds exactly, right? I'm going to be a fraction of a second off. So now you have a loop of single notes every 19 plus or minus seconds, right? Then I'd play that back, and it wasn't a piano, it was mostly a Yamaha DX7.
Ah.
And then I choose another note, you know, an E, and I'd set the timer for 27 seconds. Mm-hmm. And do the same thing and wait 27 seconds and play the note, wait 27 seconds, play the note. And for the first four or five layers, it was a real drag. But once you heard them all coming together and hitting at random different times and making weird clusters and weird gaps, it started to sound really cool. And I, you know, I kind of knew I was onto something.
Yep.
And I still kind of do that way. I mean, almost everything I do is like that, except I'm dealing with like a looping pedal with 10 seconds of memory, right? And it's so just, and it's an automatic loop instead of me having to do it manually. But I do, when I'm overdubbing or when I am playing like a part into Pro Tools, onto a track, I often play everything. I don't use MIDI. I do like to, even if it's a repeating part, I like to try to play it repeating so I get the human error in there, you know, instead of just playing some MIDI notes and then looping it, you know. So it's really a combination of like, yeah, using loopers that are doing it for me or doing it by hand, you know, with a timer or just with feel, you know.
Wow.
Yep.
I think eventually in SOMI, like as the loops got denser, I think I maybe went in sometimes and without a timer and just dropped in notes where I think they were needed, you know, if I recall, you know, wasn't completely strict the whole time.
This is the thing that's inspirational, is it seems like you have like, you come up with the workflow first as the inspiration to the thing. And that's what I've kind of gotten from speaking to you over the last, you know, year or so. And even in terms of like this whole process, I feel like not only for myself, but it's since SOMI has come out, it's kind of almost created a language for newer artists to come in and sort of do something similar and be okay without being on the grid or using semi-randomized generators instead of using, you know, whatever app you can completely randomize things in. And it's completely something that I've been using ever since talking to Andrew and getting an iPad, because that'll always come up. You know, there's an app called Koala Sampler, where, you know, you just, I think it's up to like 2 minutes or something. You can just load in a phrase. And instead of doing one at a time, I just load in like super randomized phrased in key. And then once you have like 10 layers-ish, it really turns into like this cloud of just really lovely ambience or just noise every time. It's almost a cheat code. It's crazy. And then you have to use, you know, your own taste, you know, to actually create something.
Well, that's where you find your voice, like, right? When you're using generative things is how to become a good editor, right? And not just accepting what they give you.
Yep.
But then, you know, either randomizing it over and over and over until you have something that you gel with, but then going in and pulling out notes or, you know, like editing it down to, you know, something that works instead of just, blindly accepting what it spits out.
Yeah.
I mean, Marcus, going back to Marcus, he and I have talked about this and we both work in this way, which is building up a lot of layers until we feel like we have too much. And that's sort of the end of the tracking or the recording process. And then it's like just a ton of carving away and erasing and, you know, peeling everything back and peeling as much back as you can while still retaining the essence of what you were after.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I've done also is like, you have like some bed, some sound that's the basis of your song, and you're adding everything with that original track in mind on top of it, and then going in and completely, and then deleting that original thing. And that original thing was the basis of everything. It was the hook, it was the what inspired you. But sometimes you do that and you simply delete that, and everything you've added on top, because it's relating to that and inspired by that, still sounds great. And it's like, it's kind of like a ghost of, you know, that original idea, but it still works.
Yeah.
You know, that can be kind of cool.
I love that. Yeah. I was actually talking about something really similar, with a friend a week ago or so, but I was saying one thing I like to do now, and I've been trying to do this more, is when you have an initial idea that inspires you or something that excites you, wait to reveal that a little bit and like bury it for a little bit, or even remove it entirely. Wait to show your hand, with that thing that excites you, and see what that can build around it. See what that inspires you to do, before you show, you know, that card on the table. So I've been thinking a lot about that.
You mean like in a song, like before you reveal the
yep.
the hook of a song or, yep. or whatever. Yeah, that's yep. cool.
Yeah. And regarding like the loopers and everything, yeah, that the process you're describing there to me is like the exciting part about this kind of music that we make. If you can put your ideas into a looper, let that build, and then leave room for the processing and the shaping and the carving and the sculpting, that all that work to me is the real that's the really exciting work that we get to do. Interesting to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah it is. I love that part of it, but it's also like the hardest part, yeah. because it's like we all struggle with, you know, when do you stop editing and when do you stop tweaking it, you know, when's it done, that kind yeah. of thing, you know.
Speaking of I think studios as instruments or studios as tools to be utilized, I know you've been working on a new mixing space over there. I'm curious if there's any kind of, you know, motivation or philosophy that's guiding the construction of that space for you. Is it meant to facilitate specific things that you can't do in your mastering space, or is it more just fundamental putting yourself in a new location and a new headspace physically that's apart from your mastering space?
It's both of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first inspiration was that I'm kind of getting crowded here. So I got a lot of gear and sort of running out of room. The other motivation is that really is because I've got two studios in one here. The mastering rig is completely different signal path, completely different gear, different converters, you know, sandwiched on top of all of this other writing gear and mixing console and stuff like that. So, and it works well, you know, I've got it dialed in ergonomically pretty nicely. But really a traditional mastering room should have nothing else in it besides your mastering desk and a couple of speakers, mm-hmm. right? So I really want to get back to, I mean, I got this big mixing console in front of me, dead center, that I'm sitting in front of now, and it shouldn't be here. The mastering gear is to the left and right of that. You know, a foot out of reach in either direction. Not bad, you know, totally works, but I'm really looking forward to bringing these two side bays of mastering gear back together again, like I used mm-hmm. to have it. And everything's front and center. The room is really empty besides the mastering gear and the speakers.
Yep.
So that's, in addition to building a new studio space, this space that I'm in actually becomes new again because, you know, 75% of the equipment's going to be gone.
Yep.
And then in the other room, when I was talking to the acoustic designer who I worked with for this room, we were the most important thing over there was vibe,
yeah.
right? For the writing room, it's got to sound good. I don't want it to sound like trash, but it's got to be inspirational. And the vibe comes before the acoustics there. And Brady's seen it in, you know, where yeah, it was almost a couple months ago, and we're close. Like, I thought I could actually start moving gear in this week, but we had a problem with some ceiling acoustic treatment, and the electrician hasn't finished gotten the inspection yet, but probably by the end of this month I'll start moving gear in. But I'll be sitting in front of three like 4-foot by 9-foot windows, you know, just like 20 feet of glass in front of me that looks out up into the woods, and that's the inspiration for me, right? Yep. I was gonna put the desk on the other side facing the wall because it was a little better for the flow of the room, but the acoustic designer said, do you want to be looking at a wall all day, or do you want to be looking up into the woods all day? So that was an easy answer. But, you know, so it's just, I have the luxury to be able to separate these two parts of my musical life, the mastering 9 to 5 and the creative space. And going back to what we talked about at the top of this, like wanting to get out of the studio after mastering all day, I think is really going to be nice to go into a different space instead of coming back into the mastering space to sit at the same computer, you know, whatever. So it's just, it separates that for me. It clears out the rooms a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
I think when I came in and visited, you know, and we were talking about this all, it really surprised me when you were talking about how you were preferring the vibe over the treatment and stuff, because as somebody, you hear the dog.
Yes.
I think I'm a typical person where I get so caught up on technicalities for no reason. Like, I'm always like, okay, what can I do to better treat the room I'm in, which is going to be impossible to treat perfectly. And honestly, there's no reason to, because I'm not a mixing engineer. I'm not a mastering engineer. There's only writing happening in this room. And so I literally, like, I think almost probably a couple weeks after I got back, I was like looking at my studio space or my office space, and I was like, I don't even like it, you know, because it was like I had followed the rule where it's always supposed to be on the smallest or the shortest wall, you know, your speakers and stuff. And it's never supposed to be on the longest one. I was like, but I would have so much more room if I just changed the orientation.
Right.
And so I did that. And honestly, and I got myself a little cart that holds some synths and stuff that I can wheel around. Doesn't look great, but it makes it so much easier. And like, it really opened up a lot of possibilities for me. And it was really weird just sort of being validated by somebody that I look up to, being you, Taylor, being like, that's not like the first priority. You know, if you're in a writing space, make it a writing space that actually you want to write in.
I mean, it's a huge balance between, proper acoustics, workflow, and vibe, right? Those are the three things. And you get a school of people, you know, over on GearSpace, you know, especially the mastering forum, where, you know, they see your mastering room and they see a synth on the wall and they start freaking out because of the reflections that synth is going to cause and screw up your imaging. And maybe does it matter? No, you know, you're going to get a 10th of a dB of, you know, it doesn't matter. In print, you know, on certain levels, it does matter. And my mastering room here does sound really good. It's not perfect. I don't know what the other room's going to sound like. I'm a little nervous, you know, because I know what it sounds like because the acoustic treatment's up and I'm in there and I'm talking and I know that it sounds pretty good, but I have no idea what music's going to sound like. But I can always like bring a mix into here or whatever. But it's really like, you guys can ask myself this, or I tell myself this, and you guys can do the same thing. It's like, are my mastering clients happy? You know, yes, they are. Do I have a lot of them? Yes, I do. So if those two things are true, I don't need to do anything else to this room. Moving the synth off the wall is not going to, Andrew's not going to come back and say, damn, my master sounds so much better because you moved that synth, you know. It's not... that has no, you know, maybe it's better for pictures and this or that, but you have to, are you happy with your music? Is it selling or streaming as expected? Do people like it? If the answer is yes, then you don't have to do anything else to your room.
Yeah.
You know, or the gear you use. It's nothing at all about the gear. You know, the gear is 0% of the end result.
Yeah.
At least to me, I only use all this gear because it makes me happy to look at it and touch it, you know, and Andrew makes better music than I do on an iPad. And it has nothing to do with the gear. It only has to do with the person, you know? Even in an engineering point of view, I think, you listen to, you can listen to crappy recordings that inspire you and make you so happy, something old or, like really old or whatever. And it's, I don't know, it's all about the emotion. And I think it doesn't really have anything to do with the equipment. If you're Brady, if you're happy and your workflow is better and you're still writing good music, then, your setup is successful. It's always constantly, and we're always tweaking our spaces, that will never end. But I've learned not to freak out about it so much.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I don't feel the need to go and get a studio designer and spend all the money because I'm in a lackluster room anyways, it's going to cost a lot to make this room perfect. And like you're saying, you end up getting used to the space you're in, right? You can hear the issues with it if you're just comfortable with your monitors or with your headphones. I mean, headphones completely take the equation out,
Right.
That's a whole other conversation. But yeah, if you're listening to your music constantly on the monitors you're using to mix or master, well, mostly mix, then you're all good, you'll get used to it.
I can say that like a mastering situation is a bit different. And it's what led me down the path of like super nice converters and super nice monitors and a well-designed room is because I have a responsibility for other people's music. And that freaks me out. So because the mastered product is now their album and it's what everyone is going to hear.
Exactly.
So my responsibility to them is to not screw it up, and so things like really good converters are going to make sure that that part of the equation is taken care of. And do they need to be these ones? Maybe not. They could be something else or something lesser, but it's like when you do have that responsibility for someone else's stuff, you have to, if it's my stuff, I don't care.
Yeah.
I can screw it up all I want, but I can't screw up your guys' masters because that would make me feel terrible,
Yeah.
So it's it's a little different situation when you have a mastering room than than a creative writing room, I think.
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be curious to hear your perspective on this, Taylor, but how often, I know you said you feel that responsibility and you feel a certain degree of pressure, I guess, to deliver, music for other people when it's in your hands. I do think it's interesting though, and if anyone hasn't seen it, the philosophy page on your mastering site, I love the photo you've got on there with that, rain splattered window, and there you talk about the imperfections mm-hmm. that are inherent to that image and that's what makes it beautiful. And you also say that you don't claim to be a transparent mastering engineer, which is I think honestly why
no not at all
why I love sending my music to you is because you are an artist yourself and you can put yourself I think in a slightly different pair of shoes rather than just a purely clinical clean perfectionist type of situation. And I think that perspective is really valuable to have in a mastering process. So do you find just anecdotally, I guess, do you find that people come to you for that perspective? Do you treat mastering as a clean clinical job to do? Or have you started to, I guess, assume the role of like artist in that job more than you did previously?
A lot of people do come to me and say how much they like what I wrote on the website. Mm-hmm. That being said, like every mastering job is different, right? And so if I get a solo piano record, which I get a lot of, that's going to be a pretty clean master, yep. right? Solo instruments in general, when you have one instrument and there's not a lot of interaction happening or, between balancing between other instruments, I view that as my job is to make that instrument sound the best that it can. And that tends to be a cleaner you know, a cleaner mastering job. If it needs some kind of color or a little bit of saturation, you know, maybe so. But when you start getting into, you know, music with a whole bunch of different voices and, you know, especially like, you know, our kind of ambient music, you know, tape hiss and stuff like that, then I definitely do take on, you know, a more artistic mm-hmm. role. I think just because I can't help it. It's, you know, I master the music how I want to hear it. And 99% of the time, the clients agree with me.
Yep.
But I'm not always right. You know, sometimes I'll, you know, I like to bring out certain sounds or bury certain sounds, and it's purely, you know, purely my opinion or, you know, the way I want to hear it. Because I don't think I can be any other way. Yep. You know, I can't master something pretending to be somebody else, if you know what I mean. And like I said, sometimes I'll take it in a direction the client, you know, wasn't wanting it. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what the communication's about. A lot of times I take it in some direction that the artist wasn't expecting, and they're completely blown away. They're like, I've never heard my music in this mm-hmm. way. You know, there's sounds in there that I forgot about, or that like I didn't even know were there that you've pulled out, and they really like it.
Yep.
And that's when it's the most exciting for me. So in that regard, you know, that's why I don't call myself a transparent mastering engineer, because I'm absolutely putting, you know, my own take. And I've worked with other mastering engineers for projects, and, you know, they don't do anything. It's like they run it through a couple dBs of a limiter and turn down a quarter of a dB and at 1K or something. It's like, that's not doing yeah. anything. No one cares if it's a quarter of a dB less or more.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you can, if you're listening for it, you can hear it, but that's not going to make or break the record.
Yep.
If you looked at some of my EQ curves in mastering, you'd probably be pretty shocked, you know, at the amount that I'm pushing and yep. pulling things, but I don't know, somehow it works. I want to be responsible for those changes. I don't want my gear to be responsible for those changes. Going back to like the transparent thing, or like the gear, like the speakers or the converters, like let my signal chain be pristine and super high end and not cause any damage to their signal, yep. right? I want to be the one that screws things up or causes the damage or makes the mistakes. I don't want my gear to do that. Mm-hmm. Cause it's easier for me to correct myself than to correct the gear.
Yep.
Right. So, make sure everything is high end and awesome and really high quality. And then let me make the creative decisions on top of that, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. I think that's why people typically come back to you too, is because when you're working with you, it feels almost like a collaboration in a sense. And like, even though you're saying all this, you are very respectful, where it's like, you will send an email being like, hey, there's this noise. Is this musical or is this air? You know, sometimes.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
With noise, kind of music. Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I end up doing though, especially in the mixing stage, and this is for both you and Andrew, especially when I'm using a lot of reverb on drone tracks or something, I end up just chasing harmonics. How do you guys get around this? Do you just have a threshold where you're just like, all right, just let it be because it is? Or what? Because eventually you get to the end of it where you've taken down 30 dB on like specific frequencies all over, and then you take off the EQ and it sounds better than it did, you know,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the time. How do you guys get around this?
Well, doing that, I mean, you have to like, you have to constantly A/B your changes, yeah. you know, and especially, I mean, writing or mastering, like I'm always yeah. chasing resonances, and to the point where it's like, I'll just cut so much, So, you know, the funny thing about resonances is you, if you cut a couple peaks near each other, it has the same effect as boosting the frequency in between those peaks.
Exactly.
So you cut these two peaks, now you've created a new resonance
in
the middle of those, and then you cut that, and by the end of the day, you've got nothing left.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem, and it's a hard balance, you know.
I'm you say that, Taylor, and I'm thinking I can literally see the ProQ UI as you're talking about this, and that's where I start to,
that's what I was seeing
in these situations. It's I have to remind myself maybe don't look at the screen for a second and stop mixing with your eyes and just learn to trust what you're hearing and take a step back every now and then, because you say, you can just start notching out everything and then amplifying other things, and by the end of the day you're nothing sounds like you wanted it to in the first place. And if you're trying to fight something that hard just based on a visual representation of it, that's where I start to have to tell myself to cut it out for a second and just let's take a step back and trust what we're hearing, and not necessarily what we're seeing.
Yeah.
That's my perspective on it, but
it's similar. There's a gear company called Kush Audio.
Mm, yep.
This guy, Gregory Scott, he makes compressors, outboard. He makes plugins too now, but outboard compressors and EQs and stuff like that. And he has a YouTube channel. And he hasn't done anything a while on it, but I actually quite liked it. And it would be him. He's got the super mellow voice, and he'd be in his studio and he'd talk about, recording and mixing tips and stuff like that. And there's one thing he said, I don't know when, a couple of years ago, that has always stuck with me. And it's when you're looking to make that change in the song, in the mix, whether you're turning up a vocal or turning down the drums or notching out a resonance. And I'm paraphrasing here because it's been a couple of years, but the idea stuck with me, is that how does it serve the emotion of the song, right? How does it serve the big picture? Mm-hmm. Are you doing it because it's annoying you and it's a technical thing and on screen it looks like a terrible resonance, or are you doing it because it serves the big picture, serves the emotion?
Yep.
And it's a really hard thing to train yourself to do, especially people like us who are audio engineer geeks, and half my brain is creative and half my brain is super technical, it's try not to look at the screen or ask yourself, is that resonance really that bad?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that always stuck with me, trying to make the changes for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And maybe the right reason is technical, or it is a lot of times, but make sure, that you're doing it for the right reason. And another old adage that is always true is turn something up till it sounds good and then go back a little bit.
Yeah.
That always works, Very it's true. Cause you get that, you hit that certain spot, especially with this hardware gear, and it's you're turning that knob and you hit that spot where you get that euphoric, because you're turning it up until you hear what you want to hear, and you get that, there it is. But it's, you're doing it because you want to hear that change.
Yeah.
But it's not always what the song needs. It's you need your affirmation that you've turned the knob and enough, physically, enough. And it's so many times it's just too much. So it's always good. It's turn it to where you like it and then back it off a little bit.
It's a mental confirmation bias.
That really works.
I know I've turned it up.
And there's so many, you don't know how many times I've turned up, especially this massive passive EQ that has so many on-off switches on every band. I get that sweet mid-range boost I was after, go on with the rest of my mastering and realize that the thing was bypassed the whole time. You know, it's just, that's happened so many times where I'm hearing it. I turn the knob and I hear it, but it's bypassed. It's physically, it's not happening, but my brain knows what it's going to sound like and knows what it's after. And just turning that knob goes, oh yeah, that's it. And the thing's bypassed.
You know? We need to produce a,
it's, that's, you know, not what I should be, not what my mastering client should be hearing, but
produce an empty rack unit called the placebo that does literally nothing.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. There's, the monitor controller I use, that I used to use and I'm about to use again by Dangerous Music, yep. Mastering gear company. Did I show you this, Brady?
You did, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a monitor controller, and there's a button on it called the PPPI or PPE or something, PPP. Yeah. It's the producer pacification indicator, and it does nothing. And in the manual, it says how to use the button, and it says when your producer's sitting next to you and he wants some ridiculous change, like a tenth of a dB off the mid-range vocal, press this button and say, do you like it like this or like this? And the button does nothing. And 100% of the time, they're going to choose one or the other. And then you just leave it like that and then go on and print your mix.
So good.
So it's a completely placebo button.
So good.
Built into a piece of gear and written in the manual. It's so brilliant.
Oh, man. There's so many things like that, too. Oh, in not only mixing, mastering, but in scoring and stuff. Mm-hmm. Directors will come back to you, be like, oh, I need this change. I need to sound more like this. And then, you know, you do a couple changes, but then for the fourth change, you just go back to the original.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
I love it.
Yep.
It happens so often.
Yeah, that happens. And I mean, it's like, I mean, I think we're all, you know, it's just human. It's like,
yeah.
Or sometimes you hear something, you need to hear something just to know that it's not what you want, you know, or like, yeah. But placebo is very powerful.
For sure.
I ran a master this morning where I had like a whole EQ on in the circuit that wasn't supposed to be on. Yeah. Just like after I was writing down my settings, I was like, oh shit, that wasn't supposed to be on. But it sounded good. So I was like, oh, whatever. It's fine. Yep.
I could think of another question I want to ask, but I do want to be sensitive of time. So if we need to stop, just let me know. Otherwise, I'd love to ask.
Yeah, it's up to Brady.
I'm good to go for however long. Literally, Taylor, it's up to you. I mean, I know, Andrew, we've gotten through like, you know, half of our questions that we wrote down. So we obviously don't have to ask.
We're prepared. But yeah. I would like to pivot just a little bit and just ask you about live performance for a minute, Taylor, because I know we played a couple shows fairly recently. And I think I remember talking with you about it before one of the sets, but I don't get the impression that you enjoy solo live performance very much. I'm thinking of like the show, I think we played in New Hampshire, but you know, right before we started up, I think you had agreed with Chet and Micah, who we were playing with, that you guys were going to do an improvised set together. Would you say that you prefer improvising with a group over playing like solo pieces? Or what's your thought process going into a live show? Is it always improvisation? Do you ever walk into a room trying to convey a specific thing, or do you leave it more or less open to kind of the spur of the moment?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts on that. I'm not a big live performance guy. I think in addition to stage fright, which I do suffer from a little bit, it's not debilitating, mm-hmm. but I'm such a studio like control freak that once I get in the live situation, everything is out of my hands and it gets, you know, I know what I want to do, but because it's on the spot and improvisation and I'm not in the studio where I can stop and redo it and overdub and rewind, you know, so I'm rarely happy with the way the performances come out because they are all improvised. I'll come up with a set of gear and a system, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll run through some, you know, rehearsals or whatever at home before I go out. So I think I'm really hard on myself in that way. When it does work, I really love it. You know, when it like totally gels and I have, if the venue's really beautiful and cool and it, you know, then I really do like it. It's just, you know, my initial gut is to turn down the performances because I'm tired of being so unhappy with them and find it easier just not to do them.
Yep.
But playing with someone else, I could do all day long, because everyone's not looking at me, you know, they got two or three people to look at. I can screw up and Chet or Micah is still going strong and it doesn't matter so much, you know, like it's not much different than collaborating in the studio where, you know, when there's someone else there, it's better, easier to bounce ideas off of and, you know, and that kind of thing. So, collaborative performances, I really do like doing. And it's funny, I've found over the years, at least a lot of touring Japan, is that the people don't like the collaborative performances as much. The audience wants to see the solo artist. Yeah, you know, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a Japanese thing, or maybe, I don't know, maybe specific to the bills or the venues or something like that. But the problem, and, you know, I'm really jealous of Marcus, bringing up Marcus again. Yeah. Marcus has such a system, and a lot of people do, you know, but I've played so much with Marcus that I just, you know, see, you know, he's got such a system dialed in where, and I love his performances. They're all, even, you know, even when he doesn't like them, they're amazing, but he's got a system that he knows and that he can repeat. Even though that's improv, he can, you know, he knows what all the gear's role is and how to work it and how to improvise with it. Part of that's because he plays live a lot, you know, maybe not so much in the last year or so, but like traditionally he played live all the time. So he's constantly practicing with the system he makes. My problem is that I would like spend a week in Japan once a year and by the time the next year rolled around, I forgot what I did. Mm. And every concert, I'm reinventing the live gear.
Yeah.
And when, you know, so every time is the first time and you don't know it and it's intimidating and you don't quite, you know what you're doing with it. I think if I played live a lot and just said, this is my setup, this is the gear that I use every time, you know, with maybe a couple little variations, then you get, you know, used to it as a single instrument.
But
because I have to reinvent myself every time, that's what doesn't work for me.
Yeah, we've toured with Marcus two times now. It's amazing. He can just walk into a space and just instantly size it up, know, like, you know, where he needs to be, where he needs to place his tape loop, how he's going to approach it. We even played a show one time where there was just happened to be a piano incidentally on stage and he got up at the end of the show and played the piano like to close the set. And I don't have that ability. Like, as someone who is primarily playing in a trio and bouncing ideas off of two other guys all the time and withdrawing, like you say, towards the background and not having all eyes on me all the time as the only person making sound. Yeah. I'm super jealous of guys like that who can just instantly lock in and do that repeatedly. I do not have that ability. so I was interested to see your perspective on how you treat it as a performer yourself.
Yeah, I wish I was more comfortable with it because I do like traveling and visiting other places and seeing my friends around the world. And touring is what gets me there. I have to come up with a set of gear that I'm comfortable with, you know, that I can repeat.
Yeah. You do have a show. I don't know if you want to talk about this or not. If not, it's all good. But you do have a show for the upcoming record that you're putting out at Public Records, which is going to be really, really cool. How and I guess to give context, it's going to be you and oh my God, what's Joe's last name?
What, Joe Brancefort?
Mm,
yeah. Yeah, with, yeah, Joe Brancefort. How are you preparing for this one?
Since
it's going to be with, oh no, you haven't started yet?
Oh, we're going to, yeah, we're going to, we don't, Joe thinks he's got it figured out, but
okay.
We're going to be playing with Madison, the clarinetist, and I think Chris, the cellist.
Mm-hmm.
Joe will have vibraphones. I don't know what I'll use, but I think we're, unlike the record, I think we're going to have to use loopers and stuff like that, because the parts are so physically exhausting for Madison to play mm-hmm. on clarinet and stuff. So Joe thought that Joe mentioned an idea he had that sounded pretty good, but yeah, I'm not exactly sure how we're going to pull it off yet.
For
but
sure.
I think it'll be me looping the players.
Oh, wow. In real time.
In real time. And we'll have to do a couple rehearsals and stuff like that. But
yeah, I think that the listeners of this are going to have no context, and I'm not going to give them any context either because I don't want to, you know, talk about still too much. But, you know, I might cut that part out. But I do think that it's exciting. And, you know, when it comes to live performance, all I can think of is stress personally. You know, I'm like, there's nothing I'd rather not do than a live performance. That's why I've only ever done two. But it is definitely something that I would also like to get better at, or at least get more comfortable with. And I think, yeah, like what you just said, just having a strict setup that you always know instead of relearning it every single time you have to perform is probably the way to go, you know, in order to get sleep the night before.
Yeah. Or some, like, you know, there may be some benefit to relying on some sort of pre-recorded, you know, backing tracks or like, you know, long phrases where you can, 'cause like I've traditionally not used those. So when everything breaks down and starts to sound like crap, there's nothing to back that up. You know, I can't switch over to a pre-recorded 5-minute sound, you know, that I can use just to reset and like sounds nice, you know, while I, you know, redo the live part of it. That would probably help, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, something that I've always done, thankfully, I don't even remember where I got the idea or who I was copying, but I essentially play the 4-track with some guitar overdubs, you know, and just so that if I forget what notes are in this song, I just sort of play the sliders, play the pedals, and then maybe have a sampler up there or two and, you know, hit the xylophone.
Yeah.
And I think it still works.
Yeah, I think you need some sort of something to fall back on or... Whereas if you're collaborating, you know, you've got the other person to fall back on. Yep. So when you're by yourself, maybe it, you know, helps a little to have, a tape or, something to back you up if all goes wrong.
Yep.
Exactly. Something I wanted to get into because I've suddenly become super passionate about it. I guess it makes sense, you know, starting to work for network and stuff. I've become super interested in just labels in general and how they're working now versus also not working now, you know what I mean? And so going into 12K, you know, especially for small labels, things are pretty difficult now. You know, vinyl prices, shipping prices, everything is just actively working against smaller labels and independent labels, I find. But are things as bad as I think they are in my head for independent labels, like generally?
Probably, I'd say. I mean, I think it's different for every label. I think I really want to be a physical product release label. And like you said, like, it's mostly like the shipping. The shipping's just ridiculous. And, you know, it doesn't hurt me as much because I charge the customer for the shipping.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine, I feel bad for these customers that have to pay, you know, $27 to ship a $20 record. And I don't blame them for not wanting to do that, you know. So fortunately, vinyl production times have come back down into a normal, it doesn't take like 6 months or a year to get vinyl back. I love CDs, but no one has a CD player, including myself.
Yeah.
But I'm releasing nothing but CDs going forward for a while. But, you know, after that, then you're stuck playing the algorithm game, you know, and that's not something I'm interested in doing for the label. I'm glad I have another label that can do that for me. But, you know, it's like, yeah, it's just like this social media algorithm game to get, you know, to get your plays. And I don't know, you know, I mean, it's probably a generational thing, you know, it's not, I don't stream music myself. I don't listen to streaming music. I mean, occasionally I do with my kids, but like, you know, so I don't know. It's just like, it's a whole new, you have to worry about a whole new set of things than you used to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So if you're not sort of actively streaming music often, how are you consuming music generally?
I think I'm the last person on the planet who buys music from iTunes and imports it into my library or Bandcamp. I mean, I buy a lot of music on Bandcamp, but I download the files and I add it to my iTunes library.
Yeah.
You know, because that library, you know, has become, it's just the central hub to all my music, but it also feeds like the Sonos wireless system throughout the house. You know, Sonos reads off that library. So, you know, everything, I buy everything as downloads and add it. I didn't even know until like a year ago that you could stream music on Bandcamp.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like people are like, uh-oh, Bandcamp's being sold, you know, download all your streams. I'm like, what do you mean download all your streams? I've already downloaded, you know, everything. So I guess you can, and that's probably pretty cool, right? You can take your Bandcamp app and have streaming access to everything you bought. But I'm just such a, you know, old person that, you know, I want to download it and put it where I want it, where I know where it is and where I have it organized and alphabetized like I want it. Everything's lowercase. I recase every single album in my library. The artist and the album name have to be lowercase. I don't bother with the song names because there's too many, but like when I download a new album, I go in and retype the titles and stuff. It's got to look a certain way when I'm looking at it in iTunes.
I love that.
Yeah, it's just a silly graphic design.
Aesthetic matters. No, I get it.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm buying downloads, you know. And
I guess that makes sense too. Like looking at 12K, it's very much not a streaming label, which would make sense if you're not streaming. You don't want to be making this label where you don't even interact with the music anyways. You know what I'm saying?
Right. But I understand the importance of streaming, right?
It's, yes.
People get, you know, oh, you know, we got to take all our music off of Spotify because Spotify sucks. And Spotify does suck. But you look at the streaming reports and 99% of all your listens are coming from Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a responsibility to my artists to try to pay them something. And I do have artists that have wanted to take their music off of Spotify, and we have. And I've had artists that have wanted to put it back because they realize that it's a necessary evil.
Yeah.
And you take it off of Spotify, and now people just aren't going to find it.
Exactly.
That's where, so, you know, so much of the current generation looks for music, and it's more, way more than Apple Music, you know, it's like, or, you know, any of the others. It's, so, yeah, they pay crap, and unless you get on a playlist, a big playlist, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, everything will change, right? It's just like, you just have to go with, it's just like a ocean current. I don't know. That's what I feel like. I'm just, the label just floats. You know, ideally Spotify would die and everyone would go back to buying music again. But in the meantime, I'm just going to float along with it because it's the best way for people to find the music. I'm a political person inside, but I'm not like, you know, one of these people that are going to rail against protest. And I don't know, I'm just not really that kind of person. So
yeah,
if that's how people want to, if that's how a generation of people want to find the music, then that's what we got to do, sort of, you know.
I was going to point back to those principles again. Like you said, one is everything will change. And there's a couple others that I do think apply, like strive for timelessness. And regardless of listening format or platform, like if the music is worth hearing, it will be heard by the right people, you know? And regardless of whether it's Spotify today or who knows what tomorrow,
the Apple Vision Pro tomorrow.
Why would you let that affect, you know, the quality of your work or what you're trying to express? So that's where I think it's important to.
Yeah. And the music will move along with right?
Exactly.
It's like everyone's vinyl and CD collections have been digitized and have been uploaded on streaming sites. You know, the music, you know, moves with the times.
Yep.
And at some point, if streaming dies, you know, and whatever, like all that music will move onto a new format, you know, so that's sort of the timelessness thing, I guess, is just like, just make good music and like just deal with with how people listen to it, you know.
Yep.
Or just accept it. I don't like it, but I accept that that's the way things are right now, you know.
Right.
And sure, I could, I could say, nope, no streaming, you know, only CDs, no download codes, and you know, stand up for some sort of rights or whatever, and that's cool on some aspects, but then 30 people will hear it, you know, and that's not very fair to my artists or, you know. But I've done like that. Did I give you a copy of that cassette, Brady, The Oldest Colors? Yeah, so you know, here's a cassette that I made with, it's only a cassette. It comes with a private download code, but it's not on any streaming service. It's not on Bandcamp. You know, that was just kind of a one-time fun thing. It was like a tour tape, you know, but I decided not to put it up. But that's
just one of these days I'm going to ask you to put it up.
Not going to
have the label.
I don't even, and the songs aren't even titled. I don't even know what's on there anymore. Like
it's sounds good.
There's no titles.
And, yeah.
But you know, there's room for weird little projects like that. But I think, I don't know, Spotify seems to be it right now.
Yeah. For now.
And some people make a lot of money on Spotify, you know, it's all about, but it's all about the algorithms and the playlists, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's that whole thing, you know, I guess like you're saying, like sort of go with the times. You don't want to change the way that you make music or change the sound of your music for it. But at the same time, leaning towards things that the algorithm will like shorter songs, whatever, you know, sometimes it's what you got to do. And I think, I think that's fine, especially since there are so many options to put out like full versions or original versions on Bandcamp for like fans who really want it and stuff. It's a whole conversation and it's so complicated. Like,
yeah,
I mean, that's, I could talk about it for hours.
Yeah. The great things, thing about digital media is that it's just so, you know, it's so easy to get it up there that you can do like the 1 minute version and the 50 minute version.
Exactly.
And you don't have to press another record or press another CD. And, it sounds great. I mean, all these streaming services and Bandcamps and stuff, I think they sound fine. I have no complaints about the audio quality. But I'm usually listening in my car or whatever, or, you know, earbuds on the plane. So, but yeah, the digital stuff certainly lets you really play around with different versions, and that's really cool.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential with that type of stuff that a lot of people haven't done yet without it being gimmicky. Like, obviously there's that trend of sped up and slowed down songs and stuff just for social media, essentially, and it's working for the artists that do it, but I personally find it quite gimmicky, and I don't know
that trend.
Oh yeah, it's for TikTok. I don't know why you put sped up in the title and you pitch it up a little bit and it'll do 5 times as good as the original.
It's horrible.
one of your own songs
yeah,
or someone else's song. You take one of your own songs and you just speed it up.
Exactly. You called the sped up version, and
well, I want to do that, but slow them all down by, you know, half speeding.
That works too.
TikTok is a wasteland. Oh my gosh, it gives me a headache every time I open that app. I can't stand it. But
the thing is that, like, the ideas are cool. Like, I think if a respected artist was like, oh, I want to do like a slowed down version of this album because it's cool, then it's fine. But the minute it's because of, you know, whatever social trend, all of a sudden it takes all of the integrity out of it and it just sucks the life out of it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But I wanted to ask a question, and I hate this question when I get asked it, but so when you're in the car and stuff, what are you typically listening to? Are you listening to ambient music in the car, or are you?
No, I have very specific, like, I have a hard drive in the car that has my entire iTunes library on it, minus most of the ambient music.
Oh, wow.
Because ambient music in the car just doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
Right. So, because I found, like, or sometimes, so that SSD drive will, like, you know, feed USB audio into the car. Sometimes I'll Bluetooth my phone, which does have a lot of ambient music on it, because that's what I use when I'm flying. I'll listen to ambient music. So my phone has lots of ambient music, and if I'm listening to that in the car and like an Eno song comes on, I just skip all that stuff because I don't find it the best driving music. So I omitted that from my car hard drive. And I tend to listen to a lot of hip hop and 80s music, and all the like Radiohead and the National and LCD Sound System and all this, you know, newer alternative stuff that I, you know, really, really love. So it tends to be like, yeah, more vocal.
Yeah.
You know, driving music. Yeah. You know, something you can hear over the road.
Is that the same generally when you think of like your taste in music is like what you just said, hip hop, vocal music, like Radiohead, psych alternative or something?
What do you mean? Like
your personal taste in music outside of ambient music in terms of genre or
yeah, I mean,
artist.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s, so like all the new wave and New Order and Depeche Mode and all that stuff has always been with me. And then in the 90s, like when I got into electronic music, I was so narrow. Like I missed the entire 90s like alternative grunge thing because I wasn't, if it had a guitar, I wasn't interested. I was such like a techno kid, you know, that it was just like house music and acid house and techno. And I like ignored all this stuff. And not until I got older and realized, you know, that my musical tastes have like super widened. I was always kind of interested in hip hop, listening to Public Enemy and Beastie Boys like back in the day. And I listen to a lot of hip hop, which mostly 90s stuff. Tribe Called Quest is probably my favorite, or Mobb Deep or something like that. But I always wonder why I listen to hip hop, because like I don't at all relate to their lifestyle or what, or the lyrics or the hardships that they're singing about. You know, it's, you know, so I love it on a technical level, and the tempo and the repetition and the minimalism, mm-hmm. and like all this stuff, just like I love it. You know, I love it even though I completely can't relate to it.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it's even the same with me. Like Gangstar is one of my favorite rappers, just because I don't know. I guess when I was growing up, he was on like the, you know, the video games I was playing. or something, but it really sticks, you know? Like, I think what you're saying, the minimalism of the actual instrumentation and the composition, it's just good, you know? It's like, how do I say this? It's like they weren't worrying about anything. They were just doing it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's so nice.
Outside perception. I mean,
you know, you can say the same thing about like early techno and stuff where they're just like, they want to make music, but they can't afford any instruments except for this like TB-303 and TR-808 at the pawn shop. You know, that cost them $10 each. So what do we make with that? You know, and they invent a genre, you know, and they're not, all they want to do is express themselves in with the only way they know how. Yeah. And that's, you know, there's a energy and a naivety to that. And like,
yeah. Every time I hear DJ Shadow, I want to buy an NPC and try to replicate that workflow. But there's just something.
You don't know how many times I want to do a hip hop record, or I'm waiting for like Q-Tip to call me and say, give me some beats that I can, because I can. Like,
yeah.
I can give him some beats that he would like. Like, I know I can. But like, you know how many times I've wanted to do like a hip hop record. It would just be really funny coming from me. But like, I bought a SP-1200 like 10 years ago.
Yep.
With the intention of doing an ambient record with 10 seconds of sampling time. It didn't work out and I sold it regrettably.
Yeah.
Man, that's the next era.
Or like I love like lo-fi music, same, right? Like, and it,
yep,
I guess stems from my like of Boards of Canada, which to me is where all that came from. I don't know where lo-fi music really came from.
Yeah.
Like lo-fi hip hop stuff?
Yeah,
stuff
like, you know, the lo-fi music to study to playlists, you know, just like just those slow beats, you know, it's just so Boards of Canada. And like,
there's a lot of really clever production in that too. I mean, when you sit and really listen
and
to
and I don't know it.
Yeah.
I don't, I only know it from like, hearing it on like YouTube playlists or whatever, but I always really like it, you know?
I think because of the way that I came up at the same time where lo-fi was getting really popular as well. And for some reason there was just like, I guess I knew the producers that were sort of coming up with it. And I was kind of lumped into there, not to get too deep into it, but it's so funny how like the political side of lo-fi hip hop, it is a whirlwind. Oh, yeah. One of these days we can sit down and chat about it, especially with my friend Sean, who's pretty deep into it, who works at Network as well. I'm very thankful to be a part of the ambient community. Everything is so laid back and just like cool, you know, in other genres, especially independent genres and like underground. I don't know what words to use, but compared to those other genres, it's like a walk in the park.
Wow.
I don't think like anybody would expect something different, but you know, I feel like ego typically doesn't really come into play with our peers and stuff like this.
Right.
No matter how highly you think of somebody, for the most part, they'll be willing to speak with you or like just chat or something, you know, and it's not like that in other places.
Yeah. That's a really interesting phenomenon about the music world we live in, is that there doesn't seem to be much ego.
Nope.
And I'm sure there is. I'm sure you can point out a few or something, but like, even in the techno world, there's a lot of politics and ego. I mean, I came up in that world and tons, you know, DJ egos and stuff like that. It's pretty crazy.
Exactly. But, in drum and bass, it was like that the same when I was really into the drum and bass scene, and even in classical music, it is, you know, like the stories that I hear and I'm like, this is crazy. You guys are all just musicians, just like doing what you want to do. How are you not wanting to go out to coffee with this person because I don't even know the problems, you know?
Maybe because none of us are making any money doing what we do. But it just doesn't matter.
It's not worth arguing about. Yeah.
Right. It's not worth the argument. Let's all just be friends, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, we all know where we are, you know, and we're choosing to be here.
Right.
Yep.
For sure. I guess, for the last question, just really quick, I think we're both really curious as to sort of what's next for you in terms of your creative career. Like, are there specific ideas or anything like that that you haven't quite been able to do yet, but you like really want to?
Hip hop record.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm struggling a little bit right now, coming up with what to do next. And I've talked to you or mentioned this to you probably, Brady, you know, about like my next LP. I feel like the stuff I've been doing for the last few years, I've sort of reached the limit, or I think I've, you know, perfected it's the wrong word, but I think I've explored it enough that I don't want to just repeat myself too much, and it's time for something new. And that's the hardest place to be in musically, you know. I mean, I can keep doing what I'm doing, exactly what I'm doing, and make interesting stuff, but challenging myself enough at this point. So something like the Still record, you know, complete break and challenge. I don't know if Andrew even knows about that record. But
is that the one you re-recorded parts with Joe and clarinet, so it's like a, and everything? Yeah.
Yeah, 22-year-old like Microsound ambient record, you know, realized for chamber musicians.
Exactly. Yep.
And really I didn't do much. It's all like Joe has, you know, done the transcription and the production, and the musicians have done all the playing, but it's been really exciting. It's been a lot of work. But yeah, I'm at the point where I'm trying to explore, trying to find, you know, a way to, I don't want to take a complete 90-degree turn. You know, I'm not going to deliver a hip-hop or a lo-fi record, but I want to do something that's challenging again, but still fits, still sounds like me, you know. And I've got, someone was talking on the 12K Discord yesterday about whether we care about what other people, what our listeners think about music. And, you know, the true artist is going to tell you that they don't care about what other people think, and or the, you know, and that's obviously a great place to be in. You know, I'd lie if I said that I'm like that, you know, because I, to some degree, I, you know, I do care what other people think. And now I've got another label that I have to try to impress as well. You know, it's easier to do something for 12K when the only person to get mad at is myself, you know, because I'm the boss. But when you're dealing with other labels, you know, you have to, now I have to like it, the audience has to like it, and the label has to like it. So it's another level of pressure. And yeah, so, you know, I think I'm, whether it's an instrumental change or a compositional change or, you know, change in gear, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know yet. But I mean, you know, I'm not terribly worried. It's, you know, I've been here before, and it's it can be as exciting as it is worrisome. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whatever it's gonna be, I'm very excited to hear, you know. I mean, like you're saying, I think all of us as artists and stuff, in our heads, it might be like a huge change, but I think outwardly it'll still sound like your voice, and it won't be jarring no matter how much the sound changes, you know, to the typical listener. Like sometimes I think that I'm doing something completely left field, and then I come back to it a month later and I'm like, no, this sounds exactly the same. And it's just because I use a cello instead of a bowed xylophone.
Yeah.
And right, I think it's like this monumental thing, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited to hear about the new, whatever it's going to be.
I mean, we all want to challenge, you know, we have to keep ourselves challenged and, you know, keep things interesting. So, you know, you hit a point where you want to make some changes, and you got to find what those changes are and then explore that for a few years. And, you know, one thing I do want to do that I just keep putting off is doing another like super minimal techno record. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in like the early 2000s, I released some really minimal And I really like that stuff. I had a side project called Ondo. Mm-hmm. And just this really syncopated, like multi-time signature, super minimal experimental techno. And every now and then I got asked by different labels to do more of that stuff, like techno labels and stuff like that. And I'd love to do it. I just haven't had time, you know, to do it. And that stuff was all MPC 3000 mm-hmm. back in the day and like one or two synths. And I just don't have that workflow anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. So
oh, that would be, but that would be sweet. Great. I'm rooting for that to happen. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I listen to, you know, I'm pretty out of the loop when it comes to techno, but every now and then I discover some cool yeah. artist and get excited.
I'm a late arriver to techno in general, but I've really kind of gone down the rabbit hole the last two or three years. Get my head out of the ambient sphere for a little bit. But there is that element yeah. of like
yeah,
repetition and patterns. And I can see why there's so much crossover, I think, between those two genres in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, getting your head out of the, you know, going back to like, I mean, I listen to so many different kinds of music and like, I really only listen to ambient music when I'm sleeping or
yep.
traveling or something like that. But like, I mean, I'm a late discoverer of Radiohead, like 5 years ago, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard them and I didn't like Tom York's voice, like, you know, and I just, and then one day it just all clicked and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, these guys are incredible, yeah. you know, and like go down that rabbit hole. But I completely missed them when they were, you know, a big thing.
Right.
But man, that's the beauty of music, right? It's like, it's always new, you know. It doesn't have to be new, but it can be new for you. And yeah. it's just as, you know, doesn't matter if it's new for you, if it's 20 years old, if it's new for you, then it's exciting, you know.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of We All Speak in Poems. I'd be very, very grateful if you went and followed and checked out Taylor Dupree's music. Like I said in the intro, some of my favorite music ever composed has been composed by him. And he's been so inspirational to my career and music making journey. I would also be very grateful if you went and checked out Andrew Tasselmeyer's podcast, Sound Methods, which you can listen to on all the major platforms, as well as Substack. Both Taylor and Andrew have Substacks, and they share a lot of wisdom and information, and it would just be beneficial to you if you went and checked them out. So please do. All right, I'll catch you on the next one.